welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. This is an off-the-shelf edition of The Book Show in partnership with Northshire Bookstore in Manchester Center, Vermont, and recorded before a live audience. Playwright, author, and activist Eve Ensler traces many paths of reconnection in her memoir, In the Body of the World. It is the path of reconnection with her body after she is diagnosed with cancer, with the people of the world in the face of injustice and abuse, and with the earth. She is the author of The Vagina Monologues and one of Newsweek's 150 Women Who Changed the World. It is a great pleasure to welcome Eve Ensler to this week's book show.
Well, that was the best introduction ever. And thank you. Excellent. Thank you all. I feel so welcome.
It is so cool to be on stage with somebody who kicks so much ass.
Thank you.
you describe in the book, very early in the book, as you are kind of getting the reader ready for what they're about to partake. And you liken it to a scan. And it's a beautiful way of describing it because that's exactly how it comes out. Did you realize that from the very beginning?
Well, I think when I started to write the book, I knew I wanted to write a book, but I couldn't find the form of it. And I really feel like the book was coming from my body. I didn't write it during the cancer. I wrote it after the cancer. But I was absolutely obsessed with CAT scans and the nature of what a CAT scan is. And I was getting a lot of them all the time. The whole nature of what a CAT scan is that it you go into this machine and it takes a photograph of your body. But it's actually taking pieces, it's like a computerized photograph of your body, which the computer makes it seem like one. It's actually not one picture. And I feel like storytelling is often like that, that you get fragments and fractures and pieces of stories, and hopefully by the end of a cumulative journey, you've come up with one story or one kind of cohesive unit. And the minute I thought, oh my God, I'll write it in scans, the book came to me. It was just like, there it was. Sometimes the form just reveals, you know, the whole path.
You talk very early in the book about how cancer changes everything. I mean, anything that you knew, that you thought, that you believed, somehow gets colored by that diagnosis. Mm. Was that immediate?
Yes, it was immediate. I mean, I think it was a very profound journey and process, the whole process of getting diagnosed in operations and infections and chemo and post-operations. I was supposed to go to Haiti to go and support the women we support in Haiti and be there. And something was wrong and I had gone in. And literally one day, you know, somebody said to me, you have really, really, really bad cancer. We don't know where it is, what it is, and you have to go now to a hospital. It was like that. And it was so absolutely shocking and immediate and staggering, you know, that on a Thursday I got diagnosed and on a Tuesday I was in 9-hour surgery. It was that fast. And as I was being wheeled into the operating room, I didn't know if it was in my liver. I didn't know if I would have a permanent bag. I didn't know, honestly, if I was going to come out of the surgery because no one had any idea how far it was. It was just shocking. It was just shocking on every level. And I think that was the beginning of the, okay, something's about to change in a really big way here, or already has.
You write, I make good things out of bad. I always have. It's kind of obsessive compulsive disorder. In the end, it probably is a failure of character, unable to face the utterly miserable, heartless state of existence.
It's true.
But there is optimism there.
Yeah, I mean,
as there is in almost all of your work.
It's a Beckett kind of optimism in some ways. It's I can't go on, I will go on optimism. I don't think it's not kind of, it's not simplistic optimism.
Do you know always what I mean? Look on the bright side of life,
yeah,
kind of optimism.
It's not like kind of blind-eyed, oh, everything's happy and fabulous optimism. I think it's more, here is a horrible set of circumstances. You can either go down the path of darkness, depression, and give it up, or you can find the transformative piece in this that can move you towards the light. And I don't know why that's in me, but from the time I was young, I've always had that thing about being in the middle of the worst circumstances and going, okay, what are we learning from this? You know, and it's just always been in me. Even when things were, you know, when my father was beating me, my head against a wall, it was like watching it going, wow, this is so intense. Like, what are we learning about the human condition from this? And there was a part of me that actually was able to separate and do that. I have no idea why, but I'm glad, because otherwise I wouldn't be here.
Because most people, and I don't say this lightly, but most people would need therapy to come to that.
Well, I've had plenty of therapy.
Yeah. But I would think it was a little bit of both, right? You need a little bit of...
Oh, please, massive therapy. I mean, I didn't say I did this on my own, you know. I think what I believe fundamentally is, like, I think we grow up sometime with this idea of life that's completely not real. And so we think there's not going to be suffering, and there's not going to be illness, and there's not going to be loss, and there's not going to be death. We don't even talk about death in this country. Like, no one dies in America. They just disappear, you know? And we don't deal with sex. We don't deal with death. We don't deal with illness. We put everything out of sight the way we put people in prisons. You know, everything's just disappeared. And I think, actually, life is in those things, right? Life is in the illness. Life is in dealing with death and thinking about loss. That's where life happens. And I feel what was incredible about cancer was that it was absolutely unavoidable. You know, it was like, okay, it is here. It is here. You have stage 3/4 cancer. You could die. You could die. This could be it. So in a way, there was something very relaxing about it, because it was like, now you can deal with stuff. You can deal with it. You can't achieve. You can't write, you can't do activism, you can't travel around the world. You actually have to deal. And I have to say, it was a huge gift. It was a huge gift. As painful as it was, as horrible as it was, I had to stop. You know, I had to stop. And I had to really look at things and myself and the world in a way that I hadn't. You know, I was talking to a journalist recently, and she was saying, your book, it was really a hard read for me. It was really a disturbing read. And she said, because I realized I live from my head up. You know, I don't live below my head. I live here, and I could never stop. I'm here to get it right. I'm here to prove I'm smart. I'm here to add up. And I said to her, that's just why I got sick. You know, that was the basis of why I got sick. Mm. Because I was riding over myself, you know, to get to where I thought I was supposed to be getting to.
Most of what the book is about is this disassociation that you have with your body and becoming connected once mm-hmm. again. And understanding what is going on. Mm. And I assume that is a gradual process as you go through the many stages of the illness.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, people have been saying to me, it's so ironic that you weren't connected to your body and all you've written about is the body. And I really do believe we teach what we have to learn, you know, and we write ourselves into consciousness, you know. And I think it's a stage coming back into your body. For me, growing up as a person who grew up in a very violent family and was constantly violated in one form or another, whether it be sexually or physically, I left my body. I had no choice. My body was too painful. It was a landscape of terror and dread. And I think I've been trying to find my way back in for a long time into this being, into this shape, into this muscle and sinew. And, but what happened with cancer, you know, was I was rushed into a 9-hour surgery, and when I woke up, after losing 7 organs and 70 nodes, I had catheters and pipes and pumps, and I was body. That's all I was. I was just a body in a bed. I don't even know where my brain was. And on one level, it was amazing. It was just, I'm in my body. I am a body. And that really began the journey of re-entering this, you know, coming back into this. And I really do believe that if it's true that 1 out of 3 women on the planet will be raped or beaten in our lifetime, which is a UN statistic and a World Health Organization statistic, that's pretty near a lot of us. And if we haven't had primary violence, we've had secondary violence, and that we've witnessed it or we know it. And I really do believe that what trauma does is it like puts a nail in the gateway, a nail in the body, in the gateway. So you just get nail after nail after nail in the gateway. Eventually, you're closed up and you can't be inside yourself anymore. And if what is inside us is divine and light and energy and creativity, then we just get progressively disassociated and separated from ourselves. And I think what cancer did, ironically, was all the nails suddenly popped out, and I was in here, you know, because of the surgery and because of the, actually the kind of intensity and trauma of everything that happened.
And even though you had traveled so extensively and had done such amazing work, with those nails removed from your body, when you started to go back, it was through a whole new lens.
Well, I think when you live inside your body, and which I have since cancer, it's a very different existence. You know, I wasn't aware of my body. I didn't know when I was tired. I couldn't feel when I had a tumor the size of a mango in me, and I didn't know it. That's pretty disassociated. I knew there was something wrong with my body, and I didn't check on it. Why wasn't I paying attention to my body? Why didn't I care for this? Why don't we care for our bodies? You know, there's such gifts. There's such gifts that we get to have. And yet, most of us, there's such places of trauma. There's such landscapes of trauma that we just remove ourselves. And I think since I've been in this body, you know, it's so different in terms of the motor, the motor that's operating in my life. For so long, it was like, I have to prove I'm not stupid. I have to prove I'm somebody. I have to prove I have a right to be here. I have to prove my father was wrong, that I'm not bad, that I'm not stupid, that I'm not. And that's gone now. That is not what is motivating me anymore. You know?
Is that different than forgiveness?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know exactly what forgiveness is. I think about it a lot. I don't feel any longer a victim, and I don't feel any longer that my life is ruled by a need to either prove my father wrong or blame him for my existence. Those two things are over. My father's over. You know, that's done. And I don't know if it means I let my father off the hook for everything he's done. But what it means is it's not determining my existence anymore. And my father's got to work out that wherever existence he is, he's got to work out his story. But he's not owning mine anymore. And his projections of his idea of who I was, being his own darkness and projection onto me, is not my identity anymore. You know, and that's taken a long, 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 long time to exhume.
Before the cancer and looking at the incredible work that you had done, certainly after the enormous success of the Vagina Monologues, there was so much there already, so much great work that you were doing. And your impulse, it seems for me, and I've talked to you several times for different projects, but that immediately after that, it was more not I'm going to go write this or I'm going to do this, but it was let's ride this and try to change stuff. Mm-hmm. That seemed to be your gut reaction to the success.
I think it was very organic, because as I wrote the Vagina Monologues and performed it, after every show, and particularly when I began in New York, women would line up after the show to talk to me. And at first I thought, oh, it'll be great. I'll hear about their great orgasms and their sexual fantasies and, you know, and their pleasure. And 90% of the women lining up were there to talk to me about violence and how they'd been raped and how they'd been incested and how they were being battered. And most of those women had never told anyone that story before. So at the end of every show, I was literally being engulfed in sorrow, engulfed in horrors, engulfed in stories. And I was either going to stop doing the show because I felt the way a war photographer feels who witnesses events but doesn't intervene on people's behalf, or I was going to do something. And that's really where V-Day came from. I got together a group of sister activists in my living room and kitchen, which I think is where all good things begin. And I said, we have this play. How could we use this play to actually end violence against women and girls? And that was the beginning of V-Day. And, you know, we thought we'd do one event in New York and we'd invite all these great actors to come and that would be it. And we'd raise money for local groups in the city who were working to stop violence. And that night was like an unbelievable night, and 2,500 people ended up coming, and everyone from Whoopi Goldberg to Glenn Close to Susan Sarandon to Lily Tomlin performed, and it was actually the beginning of this movement, you know, 16 years ago, because what it turned out was that one out of three women have been beaten and raped, and it's epidemic, and it's kind of the core fundamental issue, the mother issue that's underlying so many other issues that people were talking about. Long before me, there were plenty of women working to bring this to the light, but it had not become something that was seized by the world as a major issue, because it was so normalized and marginalized.
And yet, that can become normalized and marginalized, although I'm sure you still have problems going into certain places and saying we're going to perform something called the Vagina Monologues.
Indeed. You know, I think sometimes there are pockets of resistance where people are really afraid of the show. And then the show comes, and it's amazing to see what happens in those communities, obviously. People have huge turnarounds. Paris, for example, was one of the last places to do the show. It's run there now for a long, long time, but yeah. They were very resistant to vaginas in Paris, which was surprising.
But given that you are so much, I'm sure, I know this, much more evolved than I am, but... How you are able to, or how you can figure out and come to an understanding as to why there can be a rationalization for 1 in 3 women to be raped and abused, and yet we can't talk about our bodies, we can't say that word vagina, we can't even, I mean, and for men we can't, we're not even comfortable with penis, for God's mm-hmm. sakes.
Well, I'm really glad you're saying this, because I think one of the things I'm constantly struck by is that paradox or that bizarre twist, particularly in this country, where I read the statistic recently that 70% of boys learn about sex for the first time from pornography, but we can't talk about sex in schools. So what we're saying is that as long as it happens over there and we don't look at it or see it or touch it, that's okay, even though a completely distorted, objectified view of sexuality is coming into young men. And yet, if we say, what if we sat down in school and every school and we actually taught children or teenagers what healthy sex was, what reciprocity was, what mutuality was, what consent was, what tenderness was, what pleasure was, what it felt like, we would somehow be illicit. Do you know, I just am here to say that I don't think anything's more important than teaching people about sex. I think it begins badly, where boys are really struggling deeply to perform and pretend they know what they're doing when they don't. And in their anxiety, they jump on girls and they get scared. And girls go, this is horrible. Oh, my God, this is sex. This is the worst thing in the world. And nobody talks about it. And we begin a cycle of sexual misery and sexual oppression and a denial of pleasure. And I think the longer I've been doing this work, the more I see that not only is sex education crucial, but how we're bringing up boys is so critical to ending violence against women and girls. If we bring up our boys to disassociate from their hearts, you know, if we bring up our boys to pretend to know things they don't know, if we bring up our boys to be tough and unyielding and to deny what is feminine inside them and in the world, what do we think boys will turn into? You know, if you had told me as a child I couldn't cry, I would be a psychotic. I would. How would we release and continue and release and continue without that ability to cry? So what do boys do with all that? It's not like they don't feel it. It's not like they don't feel loss or they don't feel regret or they don't feel remorse or they don't feel all the feelings women feel, but they have no place to process that or transform that. And I think violence is so rooted in that lack of transformation.
The President of the United States recently talked about this issue, talked about sexual abuse, talked about how the numbers were staggering and unacceptable, and talked about the need of education for young men. Where does that begin?
Well, I think we're talking essentially about uprooting and transforming patriarchy itself. But where it begins is in the home. I have two amazing granddaughters who I just love more than anything in the world. And I feel so happy that I've grown up with them. They've grown up with me. I mean, I remember when my granddaughter went to school when she was in kindergarten and it was Grandmother's Day and they asked her what her grandmother did and she said, she invented vaginas, you know? And I just thought that was the best thing in the whole world. But I think because we've been in discourse about that and because she's been around that, she has agency over her body. She asks questions. She feels like she has choice. She feels like she can make demands and make questions and she can be in negotiation. And I think if we bring up our children and we bring up our boys, where we tell them from a young age, stop crying. Boys don't cry. Don't do that. You're shaming me. And mothers do it as well as fathers because mothers are absolutely trapped in the same story of patriarchy. If we do that to our boys, we are setting them up to become just like the other boys before them. And I think part of it is, how do we in ourselves work on listening to what we're saying and what we're cueing to our children, so that we begin to send them different messages about what it means to be a boy? What if you said to your boy when he was crying, "Oh my God, you're crying. Let me take care of you. What's going on? How do you feel? Come here." As opposed to shut it down, knock it off. What are you doing? And I think that has to do with women in the playground when they see a boy cry, or men in playgrounds. And rather than being ashamed that your boy's crying, embrace that your boy's crying and let them be alive. You know, I did a class once with a group of kids on legacy and what was the worst legacy. And this really brave young man raised his hand and he said, "The worst legacy in my life is the day I was taught not to cry." And he said, "I remember where I was. I remember what was happening. And I remember at that moment, I cut off my heart." And he just talked about from that day forward how he wasn't his full self. He wasn't able to be fully present or fully there for anything after that point. I don't think we realize the damage we do when we create men in idea of this kind of ridiculous manhood that everybody feels tyrannized by. You know, I think men are exhausted being men. It's exhausting. Do you know? It really is.
I'm so tired right now.
I know, right? But am I right on a certain
yes.
level?
Yeah.
It's exhausting. It's like some idea we had of what men are supposed to do. And if it was so successful, why is the world the huge wreck that it is? You know? I mean, we have to really reevaluate.
And obviously, it's not just crying. It's just emotion.
Yeah.
It's just overall emotion of allowing to not only emote, but to communicate with other people in a respective way.
And not to be alone. I think, look, when you're in your heart connects you to other people. When you're disassociated from your heart, you're very much alone. I think guys are really lonely. They're separated. They don't talk. They aren't encouraged to talk. They aren't encouraged to. And I think once that door opens, because I've seen this happen with a lot of guys who do work on themselves and begin to really, then they become part of it. They're in the equal story of humanity as opposed to, well, I'm out here and I've got the answer and I'm leading the way and I know what I'm doing. When in fact they don't. Do you know what I mean? Or we wouldn't be here. So I think, why don't we all just admit we're a big mess and we're lost together, and it's much more fun to be together lost than pretending someone knows the way, you know?
We began talking about how cancer changed you fundamentally, and I'm curious as to whether you feel that your work has changed as a result.
I think everything about my life has changed since cancer. I think when you come very close to dying, life becomes incredibly precious. I can't believe that I ever mistreated my body before this. You know, I look at this body every day with a scar that runs through my whole torso, and I can't believe that my body functions beautifully. I can't believe that it's given me this second wind and this second life. I can't believe I get to travel around the planet and I breathe and I eat and I'm alive. I can't believe that I got to have medicine and doctors who were able to take care of me, and I could afford to do that. It just seems ridiculously lucky. And I think the great thing about coming close to dying is that, in a way, you're already dead. I think part of me, I'm kind of dead. It happened, and so now I can just do anything because I'm not really afraid anymore. It's like, okay, now we have to create a revolution and change the world and make sure that everybody's eating and the earth isn't destroyed and women aren't being raped and that we aren't destroying people based on their gender or race. And I'm not really that afraid anymore because I'm already dead. So it's kind of great.
Eve Ensler's new book is In the Body of the World. It is published by Picador. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much for your incredible work. Thanks so much for inventing the vagina.
Thank you for being a great man. Yeah, really.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. This off-the-shelf edition was recorded in Manchester Center, Vermont, in partnership with Northshire Bookstore, northshire.com. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.